Welcome to episode 9 of The Andrew Hansen Show. My guest this week is PR expert and author of a new book called How to Get Your Website Noticed, Philippe Matus. Philippe started his career as a street magician, not the typical path to entrepreneurship, but a big theme of his work and of our chat today is how the skills he learned as a magician made him so successful in marketing. You'll hear him talk about how to get attention for your website, for your content, how to overcome objections, how to manage choice with your readers, all the way through to a fascinating concept called the creation of false memories, which we touch on towards the end. I'm really excited to share this chat because the ideas you'll hear talked about today, things like how to build trust with your content, how to do empathy mapping, and how to set proper, meaningful, and profitable tone with your content, are ideas that are really not discussed very well in my usual content marketing, affiliate marketing, SEO kind of circles, even though they're so incredibly important. Philippe's experience has been in implementing these strategies with large brands, and now you get to benefit from what he's learned. I'll turn over to Philippe now, and I hope you enjoy. Philippe, welcome to the show.
I'm so happy to be here.
Very exciting. Hey, we're going to be talking about magic today. It's going to be a big theme of the chat. So I thought perhaps we could start with a bit of a background on your own time as a magician.
I guess probably where I got my first interest with it was age 13. My dad was getting something done with the car, so we decided to kill a little bit of time in the local mall, and there's a magic shop there, and some dude was riffing cards around, things were flying about, called me over. I proceeded to have my mind blown with what I saw, and immediately I thought, you know what, I need some of this in my life. And then, you know, I also had the, well, you know, I could, obviously I was in high school at the time, so like maybe I can impress girls with this. So, you know, I proceeded to buy one trick. I think I did that trick 5 times in a row to the same classmates till it took completely lost its effect. But yeah, that kind of was my first start and my first taste of magic. And I think then by about age 15, I kept up with it, and I was doing a few children's parties, which then led to, I think, age 16 when I took it to the street. I had this, I think around that time, David Blaine had come out with his first magic TV special.
Okay.
Remember, he was levitating and all this cool stuff with cards.
Yeah, I remember that.
And, you know, I was at that time applying makeup to my acne, trying to fit in and be cool. and so I thought, you know, I would quite like to make a little bit of money and see if I can bring this this art to the streets. Mm-hmm. And then I did that for a few years. Yeah, that was the start.
And you were taking it pretty seriously by the end, as I understand. You were going out pretty consistently, making a little bit of money for yourself.
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, at that age, it was definitely, I could make more money than my friends, you know, working at Safeway or any of the other $6 an hour jobs that existed. It was a bit more exhausting, but you could on a good day, you could in an hour, if you're lucky, get maybe like $30 to $50 if it was a really good show. So compared to all the other jobs that existed for teenagers, it's definitely better.
Mate, we could make an ebook out of this. How to quit your job, become a magician, and make $50 in whatever.
Yeah, yeah, and you'll never pay tax in your life. You'll be off the books. But then when things go wrong, which they always do, you know, not so good.
So tell me what it's like when you're out there. You have a start of your day, your shift, or whatever. You're trying to. You have to start by getting people kind of interested, right? You were talking a little bit about this recently.
Yeah, I mean, so I'd roll into my spot, and for those of you listening that have been to Vancouver, I was about 20 meters down from the gas clock in Gastown, and so I'd usually stop by the hot dog vendor, and I'd be like, how many cruise ships came in? And he might be like, well, there's two that came in, and it's their first day here. And that, to me, was exciting, because if there's a new cruise ship or more than one, it was their first day, that meant wallets were rather fat. If it had been the cruise ship been there for, like, you know, 3 days or whatever, there people, you know, messing about in the city, usually the money was rather low, and so you're not gonna expect that great of a day.
They spent their money on poutine by that time.
Yeah. Yeah, or beaver tail. So
so you're trying to get their attention, and what kind of crowds would you have?
Usually the max. So my key prop, I did mostly card tricks, and so you maxed out at about, I don't know, 30, 35 people, because then the further they obviously stand from you, the harder it's to see what's going on. So kind of the key thing of if you notice any street performer, and jugglers are kind of excluded from this, because jugglers can really handle a large audience, and you can see balls and such being hucked in the air from a lot further down the street. It's called just they kind of break the ceiling. So for magicians, where the magic kind of happens around the around the waist level, maybe up to the, you know, up, just there's kind of a box where people are looking. You'd max out about 30 people or so.
I see. It strikes me as a very bold thing to have done as such a young guy, to put yourself to try to make money by putting yourself out there in front of a big group of strangers in this kind of high pressure environment where you hope you get the trick right and whatever. Like, I mean, do you think of yourself as being particularly like confident or bold at that time, or did it just seem like a natural thing for you to have done?
I think I quite got off, whether it was the ego or the enjoyment of entertaining an audience was quite an appealing thing at that age. It really still is. But I think the stamina, I learned it while performing. So for example, everything from a bum coming by, and there's a bit of a problem with the amount of homeless people in Vancouver, but grabbing my change, and he was a little bit touched in the head, and he opened his pants and put my hat with all my money down his pants. I just remember just watching all the change like shoot out of each pant leg, and then the hat and Bill staying there. I was like, mate, it's yours. mean, you know, I ain't touching it. Or I mean, then sometimes, like, I'd have like local teenage gangs would come and cause ruckus, and then you'd have to kind of think fast on the spot. So if someone's trying to take your money or give you a hard time, you'd have to use their ego. So I do things like three card Monty, or like, you know, just some sort of bet where you get their ego and their whole little posse to be committed to what they're saying or what you're saying, and then you work their ego against them, so you actually can keep your money and even place bets and perhaps take some of theirs. And because their pride is on the line, you would end up getting, you know, some of their money. And then hecklers were a very common, if not daily occurrence, where someone, you know, would just be giving you crap. And so the best thing would be if you had an audience of, let's say, those 30 people, where it's kind of like a full size show, you'd invite those hecklers up and make them part of the show, and again you'd use their ego and their pride to kind of put them in their place. So I think a lot of the lessons were learned during the actual doing of the shows.
Do you think, I'm thinking about these hecklers now, do you think certain people are intimidated by magic, that kind of feeling of confusion and this magician person being in a sense in control of this group of people?
I just think some people just want attention no matter what, or just want to be funny in their own way, even if, you know, it's not that funny to other people. I don't know.
That makes sense. And so, I mean, a lot of time passed, and in a a long twist of numerous events, you came to be in marketing and PR, obviously, and you've drawn this close parallel between what you learned as a magician and what you do now in marketing. And you've talked a lot about this lately, and that's what I kind of wanted to delve into. So maybe you could tell me broadly, like, where does marketing connect up to magic at the first point?
I mean, think of any magic you might have seen on, you know, on TV or live. There's a few skills I think a well-paid magician will usually have. Some of these will be: one, managing attention. So the ability to I'm not even talking about where people are looking, because where they're looking is maybe the size of your focus is really the size of your thumbnail if you're holding your arm away from you. It's about one one-thousandth of everything you're taking in visually. You're obviously seeing things around that point of focus, but that's really where the saturation of information comes through your eye. Focus and attention doesn't necessarily mean where someone's looking. So they may be looking at something you're saying, but they're thinking about something else, or they're something caught their eye, but their mind is still on a different place. So that's one skill, managing attention. Two, I think anticipating objections and assumptions. So let's say sometimes in magic you'll be using a gimmick. So something that allows you to make the trick happen, something that's maybe a little bit dodgy. If you draw attention to it or hold your hands unrealistically, or like you're doing some weird kind of move that doesn't feel natural, then their assumption that you're using something to make the trick happen will be justified. However, if if someone thinks, oh, that person, you know, you're using a fake deck, for example, which is a very common objection, I would usually just hand out the deck immediately so people can mix it, because you want to always be a step ahead of an audience's objections. Mm-hmm. And you almost want to answer them before they verbalize it, because that way you gain a bit more trust as a performer. And then I'd say one other, and then I'll get to the big skill that I think it's relevant to marketing. The third bit is providing the illusion of free choice. So sometimes there's things called forces in magic where you're providing a bunch of different options for someone, but actually you're controlling the situation to get them to do exactly or select the card that you want them to think of the thing that you're presenting. But you need to make it feel natural. And then finally, and I think this is the most applicable part of magic that applies to marketing, so I think at the root of it, a magician needs to have the ability to predict human behavior. And I think that ability to predict human behavior is how a magician is able to, if they're performing on the street, how they know when to collect money, how to increase the amount of money that they get from the show. I think how to build suspense, interest in, you know, what the tricks are doing or how you link them together. I don't think you survive as a magician if you're not if you don't get that ability to predict human behavior.
Yeah, there is a lot of stuff there to dig into. Would you mind if we kind of just went through those points that you mentioned one at a time and sort of put them in context for our audience here? So the people who listen to this show are mainly content site marketers, bloggers, mm-hmm. Some people who sell their own products, some Amazon guys and stuff like that.
Okay.
And so if I think of something like managing attention, to come back to the first one, mm-hmm. and I think about a scenario where a visitor, a prospect is coming to your site, landing on hitting a landing page of yours or a piece of content of yours.
Mm-hmm.
What is the skill of managing attention? Like, what does it make us think about, or what does it compel us to want to do with your websites in view of managing attention?
I think when you're managing attention and on a website, you get many chances to get it right. I think it's and any good marketer will already know this, but it's just being blunt and a bit raw about how interesting whatever you're doing is. So if you have a page on there and it's a really crucial web page, it's things like testing it out with, you know, a dozen people and asking them to let you know what they immediately think of the page after 10 seconds. If you have a video on your page, it's looking at the hot point as to where people drop off. So there's kind of like, just to take the video example, you've got the nose, the body, and the tail end of a video. So the nose might be the first 5 to 10 seconds, body is the long chunk, and then the tail's maybe the last 20 seconds or so. And you want to know, like, is your video interesting? So did they make it past the nose, right? Because there's the, if you look at video analytics, there's usually such a huge drop off after those first few seconds where people are quickly figuring out, is this worth my time or is this kind of a waste? And I think on a web page, the number one transaction you have whenever you present any piece of content to someone is you're maybe not asking for their money, but you're asking for their time, which is an incredibly expensive thing to give in a world where, you know, we've got 12 tabs open, our phone is buzzing, like we've got a huge task list for the day. Is can you validate that your stuff is interesting? Because so much of it's out there is boring. And I think it takes a little, it just, for new marketers, it takes a little bit of tougher skin to realize that most of the stuff you make just isn't that interesting, and that you have to really bang on over and over and get stuff to the point where it actually makes people laugh or makes people want to scroll down the page. Not easy.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out, because I think people who listen to my show who do content kind of websites, a lot of the time what they're shooting for, their goal is kind of being informative. And mm-hmm. a lot of times they do that very well. But what you're saying is that the first thing that has to be addressed, even if you hope to provide information and be informative, is that you've got to prove to them that you're going to be interesting, that this page is going to be interesting.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you get a chance. I mean, education on its own, I just see education and entertainment and just like the ease of consumption. Let's say it's copy-based, right? If you look at a page and it looks boring before you even read the copy, like that's the first thing that's going to hit someone's brain, that, oh, this looks a bit like, it just looks boring. But then they might, if they have some, for whatever reason, maybe they heard your site is good or whatever, they might give the copy a chance. But if you step and just kind of like squint your eyes and look at your screen or your page that you're building, and it looks boring, or there's big blocks of copy, or it's just not formatted, it doesn't breathe, there's no white space, then that's sending a signal that this stuff sucks. Like, and maybe your copy's brilliant, but you didn't package it in a way that's interesting, or you've packaged your design is fantastic. Like your font size is nice and large. It's not fatiguing for the eyeball. But then you don't actually have chops when it comes to writing the copy, and so you lose people on the actual, you know, consumption part. Is this valuable? So yeah, I think at a glance, does this look interesting, is actually a really important piece of keeping people's attention.
I love that. If you're listening, I want to make sure you take note of that last couple of points there. That's really serious and actionable stuff that you can go to some of your webs, your pages, your good pages, and do that kind of inventory of right now. So, Feliz, let me go into that a little bit deeper. In the time I've known you, you've consistently made me want to pay more attention to aesthetics, and as we know, in multiple areas of life. But so, tell me about this idea. Somebody gets to a web page, and even if the information is great, it looks boring. What makes it look boring to someone? Because this isn't obvious, I don't think, to a lot of people who do my kind of marketing online.
I think, and there's actually a copywriter that you turned me on to that has quickly become my favorite person to reference as to what's going on in the world of copy, and that's Joanna Wiebe. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name right. But so she's a Canadian-based copywriter, conversion copywriter, and she says she says this about copy. She says everything's got to be first answer so what, and then it's got to answer prove it, right? And I like applying that so what prove it kind of lens to everything. So everything on the page. So not just the copy, but the whole design as a whole. Because let's say so your desire when people first hit a web page is to first qualify them that this is the right page, that this is a page that's worth to spend maybe a minute on, maybe 3 minutes on, right? Mm-hmm. Which is already a big ask in ADD world. And so you're quickly going to be scanning as to if it's a brand that you're supposed to trust. You're going to look is this design something that's trustworthy? Does it look like that, you know, some money went into this, that there's some sort of a foundation behind this? Or does this look like just a cheap or a $100 template you bought for your WordPress site? Like there's such a different feel to a custom bespoke design. There even things like and a lot of people don't believe it. They're like, "Oh, logo, just spend $100, get it done, move on." Mm-hmm. And I don't buy it. Like and I just know because I've taken brands through where they don't have a fresh logo, a fresh bit of copy that summarizes who they are, and I've changed it. And I've seen the impact on sales that just getting that right initial taste has. And it absolutely makes a huge difference. And I know I've spent thousands on logos and then hundreds on logos and then free because I just cobbled something together because I needed it in the past. Mm. And there's a very big, like, if you get a good designer that understands spacing and color palettes and how the fonts fit together and, and how people's eyes, especially like, are you going for a 20-year-old or are you going for a 40-year-old or a 60-year-old? Like each 20 years, your eyes take in half as much light. And that means font size needs to get bigger as well. Mm. And when you package that all together, you hit the page, you're quickly looking for signals of trust. So does this look like this is for me? Does this look like it's by a credible source? And that look, the aesthetics are hugely important before people give you a chance to prove that to answer the prove it part of everything.
Tell me more about signals of trust, because again, my audience, a lot of affiliate marketers among them, and it's a tricky thing to build trust as an affiliate, because a lot of times you're only going to have that one touch with the customer before they end up moving on and purchasing the product that you're promoting or not. And a lot of affiliate marketers take the view that they're not going to be able to be very trustworthy, so they shouldn't bother, and there's not much they can do anyway. What are some of the signals of trust that you could employ on a typical content kind of a site, content-driven site?
So I don't claim to, I don't know the affiliates place like you do, but to me that sounds like they're going to be out of business in a couple of years. Like if
a lot of them have been, I mean, it's been happening that they came from this world of just taking things so unseriously for such a long time and trying to do the smallest amount they could to make the most money, but it's slowly kind of changing now. And that's why I think this conversation is so important.
Right. Yeah. It seems like the rate of competition is just, it keeps doubling like every like 2 years or so. Like a good podcast in 2014 is barely average in 2016, because just the supply of content out there, it keeps, and then budgets keep going more and more online. So I don't know. I might be wrong here, but I don't think you can really you can enter the arena and actually play in 2016 and forward if you're not considering making yourself trustworthy. So even let me riff on a few things that might I commonly see when sometimes when I'm consulting. You'll see it might be a page where you're trying to get an email, or you're trying to get some sort of action and prove your worth. And people will hit that page, and they don't even know that, you know, how many people have also been interested in what you're saying. They don't see any testimonials that back up what you're saying. They might not see any logos or other brands that they're familiar with that where that trust passes on. Like, you've worked for X, Y, and Z, it's recognizable, and oh, okay, well, if those brands trust Andrew, then I might trust them as well. Mm-hmm. Photos, so things like it absolutely crushes credibility is stock imagery. Like, to me, stock imagery just says this person doesn't have enough of a budget or a creative mind or a team to actually go out and get custom collateral. Things like the worst is when you're a one-man team trying to hide behind it and using stuff like we, and then the contact page says, you know, our team will get in touch with you and this and that. Right. And there's no mention of who's behind it. Like, who's going to trust that in you know, now? Like, no one's going to trust that. Or, you know? Yeah,
I love it. And I'm embarrassed too, because I've got content sites out there that are just rife with stock imagery. And it's the default for people, because a lot of people who start these kind of sites are going from the very beginning. They're trying to keep costs as low as they possibly can. They're trying to, well, they're skimping in a lot of ways because the site might not be making any money yet, and so on. You're talking about now a level up from there where you take these things a lot more seriously.
Yeah. And I would just expect that barrier of entry is going to keep going up. I just don't see how in the future you can get away with just cobbling everything together for $100 and calling it, you know, a day.
Right. In terms of the signals of trust, that is, that's a lot for people to think about. I'm keen to see what people think about that that little list there. So let me go on to the next one now. So the next principle you mentioned was overcoming objections, and this is kind of where you're sensing the problems or the arguments that somebody might have with your proposition, and doing what.
So there's something called like an explicit want and a implicit want. So if one of my, like, one of the things I like when coming up with, let's say, the pitch or the USP, like your unique selling proposition as to what, you know, getting people's interest, I like to do a little bit of empathy mapping. So typically when I'm working with a new brand, I never outsource this bit, or I never get anyone else to do it, because I want to do it myself. And that's spending about 30 minutes with at least 20 of their customers on the phone.
Okay.
And I just want to get emotions out of there. Like, I want to understand, like, why they ended up buying from you. You know, what kind of stuff they do during the day that has nothing to do with you. I want to know what TV shows they're watching. I want to know, like, what goals they've got in a year's time. I kind of want to know, like, what job your product could fulfill. So it might be something as simple as, I just want to show off to my friends with, you know, with this product. Mm. Or it might be, I just want to be a better mom, or whatever it might be, whatever your product is, whatever the job your product is solving for someone else. Like, I want to know what they explicitly say. So what they're saying, and then I want to feel out what actually implicitly they want, because often people won't verbalize that. And that's where you've got to read between the lines. Mm. And if you can get both the explicit as to what they're saying and what they're doing, and actually feel out what role or what job your product fulfills, that'll get you along the way there.
So a lot of my audience, again, affiliate marketers, they don't see themselves as having a product, because they're affiliates. Mm-hmm. They're promoting a product for somebody else. And I'm always saying to them that your content is your product in a certain way. Your content is, you're using it to help people with a problem that they have. And the problem that they have a lot of times is that they're looking at or considering making a purchase, but they're not sure which of this range of products they need will actually solve their problems.
Okay.
And in the context of what you're talking about, that makes a lot of sense, because they still have a problem. They still want this product for a certain reason, and they're having trouble making a decision about it. And mm-hmm. there's a lot you can understand within that that might help them.
I'm not following. Like, what's the question off the back of that? Sorry.
Yeah, no, that was ridiculously wordy. I just meant to say, well, I guess I'm sort of pointing out for my own audience that I want them to understand that when you're talking about here getting inside the mind of somebody who is considering your product or using your product, that is mm-hmm. the people who are digesting your content on this page, and they have a unique set of problems. That's what you're saying, right? They have a unique way of looking at this product and a unique set of things that, say, is like keeping them up at night or frustrating them, and by addressing them and understanding them, you can market to those people better.
Yeah, in your world, isn't the whole point of an affiliate marketer to be someone that's trustworthy, that whose recommendation you can trust?
Absolutely. And to try to add value to their to their search in some way, giving them some information that they wouldn't have been able to find elsewhere, and so on.
Yeah, you're perhaps a curator of good stuff that's out there, and I like this movie probably a bit too much, but it's like Donnie Brasco. Movie to you?
No.
It's Al Pacino, Johnny Depp, and it's a gangster movie, right? But they have this thing about where Johnny Depp's an undercover police, but he's undercover. And he's trying to infiltrate this this one mafia or gang, whatever it's called. And Al Pacino's there. He's kind of one of the old kind of workhorses of this gang. And he gets in with Johnny Depp, and Johnny Depp has Al Pacino. And Al Pacino says, "Okay, I'm gonna vouch for you." And essentially, when I vouch for you, it means I'm saying you're good for your word. And if you like screw with that, I might lose my life. I might, my credibility goes, it's gone. Because it's more than just saying, hey, you should listen to this person or you should buy this product. It's like, I'm putting my reputation on the line each time I say that this person is worth, your time, or this thing is worth your time. I think if you don't, it's like your life might not be on the line, like it is in the movie. But I think there's a lot of truth to that. Is you waste people's time, you abuse their trust if you say go and check out this product, it's great, and it's actually just nonsense. It's something that you recommended just because you wanted money. Like that's the short game. But then if you're the affiliate guy that, or gal that's been doing this for years, and you've built up to this reputation as to being, when Andrew recommends something, it's the real deal. That's a real career.
Yeah, the long term versus the short term. I definitely know what you mean.
And the short term doesn't even work that much anymore, does it? I don't know. Maybe it does, but
yeah, it really doesn't. Unless you're some kind of super spammer with we didn't even need to go into it. So moving through these points, then the next one that you mentioned is this idea about providing the illusion of free choice. Tell me what that means.
Yeah. So sometimes. I've been doing recently some work on these law publications. Lawyers buy these magazines that keep them up to speed in their, whether it's arbitration or whatever part of law that they're interested in, they need information on. And there's a few different, there's a few different choices as to what they can sign up for. But there's one that's kind of the most common, most popular product to buy, information product to buy. And little things, like if you have those three choices and you have one that you really want people to choose online, I mean, this is common sense stuff. So if you're listening, you might actually be becoming bored at this very point. But it says, this is the popular choice. Like, or if you have three columns with the three choices, maybe the middle column is the color that stands out. So visually, when people see it, yeah, they see your benefits and your features and your bullet points around that. But the one you want people to select is the one that stands out or says, this is what, 756 of our clients or customers have chosen this one as opposed to 40 of this and 20 of these. Like when just like a restaurant, if you can point out what's popular, that is one way to help direct people in the choice you want them to take. I'd say another illusion of free choice is if you get your offer down where you really understand like the implicit and the explicit benefit that you're selling. If you by nature make the other choices just not look that sexy in comparison. I mean, this is common sense, right? But like, if you're able to really stack the product that you want to sell and the other options as not being in comparison not that attractive, I mean that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. There's also the and you and I were talking about this, but there's the choice of, let's say, donations or how much people will pay if there's some sort of variable amount where people can donate. It's called salting the collection plate. So I learned this as a street performer, that when I had I'd sometimes use like a pickle jar or a coffee can or like a hat to collect tips. Mm-hmm. Now when I put it out on the street at the end of my show empty, I would get a lot of loonies and toonies, which is like $1 and $2 coins in Canada. I found out that when I salted it by putting like a $5 bill, maybe a couple $10 bills in there, that while I probably wouldn't get too many of the $10 bills, I noticed a notable increase in the amount of bills that came into my hat, and a decrease in the amount of coins. And that's because people take cues from what other people are doing. Just like that popularity thing, that if they look around and they're not sure how much to tip, but they see that, it looks like people are giving bills, then you're mentally priming them that at the end of the show, what's appropriate for you to do is to deposit a bill.
Yeah, I love that. I saw another great example of this. You've probably seen this, but it was in for a content kind of site. I mean, medium.com.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, they have that little feature where there's a highlight and they say six people, it's like on Kindle, six people or 10 people have highlighted this particular sentence, and you hover over it and it gives you the ability to tweet that sentence, right, or to share it or whatever. Right. It's prompting a behavior, right?
That's great. Yeah, I know. Medium clearly did it well.
Hmm. Hey, let me come back to something because I want to make this super relevant for my listeners as well.
Yep.
On the point of having a particular option stand out, what a lot of people like me do with their affiliate content is create these comparison tables where the niche is microphones or something, and mm-hmm. they list all the details they can of two microphones. So if you're trying to choose between two different brands, you can try to show at a glance why one is better than the other. But what they don't do is what you said, and actually highlight the one that's better. They pile all the information into the table, but then it's going to require somebody to sit and look at the table and look at each column to decide, okay, that one's better in that feature, that one's better at that feature. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. there's no mechanism for prompting an actual decision in that. And so you're saying if there's a comparison table where you made it clear to somebody with the color of one of the columns or something else, which was the better option, rather than having the person decide on their own, that they would get much more action there.
Yeah, it's people have limited time. So it's kind of like Google where they'll do the 10-foot test where, they'll walk back from a screen, And if it is an obvious, just at looking at it from a distance, which is the choice that is most desired, then they haven't built the page really well, and they need to fix it. I mean, it's just like on Amazon, like you've got along the right there. Usually, when you're looking at product, that orange, buy now button. And then you might have in gray underneath it, like save this to a wish list or whatever. I mean, those are two options for people to click on, but Amazon's made it very clear which one is the primary objective and which one is kind of an afterthought or something, you know, you might do on the side or if you're not ready to purchase.
Hmm. Yeah, another site that you kind of turned me onto in terms of its grasp on serving content well to its target audience was Vice.com, and it ties in. I've had a look at it since you mentioned that in light of some of these things, and it ties in a lot of the features we've kind of been talking about, not just the providing the illusion of choice, but coming back to managing the attention, overcoming objections, and content. Can you talk a bit more about Vice, because that's very relevant to my listeners, because it's a content driven site, a bloggy kind of thing. It's all trying to get attention, but there's search traffic too. Tell me what you like so much about Vice.
Oh, there's a lot that's worth spending a good half hour kicking around on that site. I think the amount of choices that they give you, it's usually one. Usually, especially if you're on the consuming the news pieces, there isn't like, hey, check out these like 15 billion other articles at the end of the article. There's usually a very natural, relevant next article that you can check, which is, you know, just there to increase their page views and advertising spend. But they limit the choices intentionally, and they get it because people don't want to be overwhelmed with, okay, what do I do next? Which, when most people on news site will just leave anyways after one article. I think they do tone really well. It's sometimes I realize I'm not the target market for Vice. I sometimes don't even like the tone, but I respect the tone because everything feels. It feels relevant to the audience. It's got kind of that gritty kind of, if you're 20 something year old, if you like what like Brooklyn stands for and like Burning Man and you know, just like, yeah. if you're kind of like you consider yourself a little bit edgy and like outspoken, or maybe you're not even that, but you just wish you were that, like it feels like the place to like get, you know, some raw news, and the photography is just, it's just all of it. It has a certain kind of taste to it. They respect tone, and it, none of it, it like it just feels like all the articles that you see on there kind of like at least from a style perspective match each other.
I'm glad you brought tone up too. I really wanted to talk about this because it's another super underrated thing with my audience. I mean, people who do SEO generally, you've definitely come across this. They spend so much time thinking about how well their content will rank and whether it is has the correct relevance and on-page optimization. And tone doesn't really come into the SEO conversation. It's a part of the conversion conversation. So tell me, speaking generally, if somebody's thinking about their market and the people they're writing for, what makes a great tone?
A great tone is usually something where part of the audience that doesn't fit it is repelled by it or really feels it's not for them.
Wow.
And one sliver of the audience is gripped by it and love it. So if you catch someone saying, oh, that's interesting, like that's like the worst thing ever, right? You don't want someone saying, oh, like it's like when someone's sharing a story and then the other person's like, oh, gee, Andrew, that's interesting. Like it usually means it's boring. I'm trying to be polite here, right?
Okay.
So you know what I mean? Like, so it, like tone has, it has voice in it. And it's like, even if you just pull the copy off of there and put it on a Word doc, like, and you just read the copy on its own, you could feel that it matches the site or whatever the brand is. If you put the photography or the design on its own, you could feel that it is a part of that brand, even when all those pieces aren't put together. And I think I mean, just because I usually work on much larger brands that already have, their brand statements are laid out. They have kind of do's and don'ts. Everything from do we use curse words? How casual is the tone of our voice? Are we friendly? Is it first person? What are we going with? Like, there's the good brands that are well established. They just have consistency. And I've seen it, like, even with like Harvard Business Review doing some stuff with them, they're so picky, like with the content that goes up. And if you compare their tone versus like Forbes or Inc. or a few of the other publications, like a lot of those have just kind of, hoard themselves out a bit and just gone for the short term, higher clicks, more page views. But because they're doing that, they're bleeding their trust all over the place. And I think most people just don't take Forbes, for example, that legitimately anymore. That maybe even 5-10 years ago, like it was a stronger brand, and now it's like, they just want loads of page views, and so they'll put up low quality stuff, and their tone's all over the place. But short term, they're making money, right?
I hate that interstitial they have as well, where there's a quote that comes in and you're waiting 5 seconds. That sucks. I always want to click back, and it's only the rare time when I really care about the article that I actually wait. Stupid thing.
Yeah. Anyway,
okay, so let me come back to one thing you said. So this idea about a repelling part of your audience and having another part just extremely passionate about it, you're talking about kind of a polarizing sort of effect in your tone. Is that right?
That's usually what interesting stuff is, like stuff that grips people. The content feels like it's something that matches their tribe, the style of content that they like, and they don't want, like, audiences don't want to like content that everyone else likes. In a big way, like, when, and think about this, the stuff that you're sharing on Facebook, we all do this. We're very careful with, like, the publications that we'll share. Like I probably won't share stuff from Fox News on my page, even if it's a good piece of content, because I don't want to be seen promoting Fox News, right? Or I think of myself as, for example, at the intellectual crowd. So you'll be sharing stuff from Monocle, or, you're like, well, the New Yorker kind of like fits the vibe that I'm going for. And so you're more likely to share content that you feel vibes with, like, your own personal brand. Because you want to pass on the information or the entertainment. But you also want that brand to reflect, like, oh yeah, this is part of what our tribe reads, or maybe you think you're independent or whatever, and you're not a sheep. I'm going to this anti-establishment, brand that's talking about this and that, I'm going to share that. And that, like, it's just how much you admit it to yourself or just without thinking about it. Right.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. So you think it's worth people asking the question as they create their content, not only who their audience is, but who is this not for? Who's definitely not going to like this, not meant to like this?
Yeah, and hopefully you're getting that feedback that, this doesn't really, if everyone's saying that that they think your stuff sucks, then yeah, you got a problem. But like, if you're getting polarizing opinions coming in, you probably have something powerful that you've got on your hands.
That is really cool, mate. There's a handful of things there that, again, people who are listening to my podcast, I don't think we'll have ever kind of heard discussed before. Very exciting. Okay, so that was the main 3 points that you talked about in the conversation about magic and marketing. There's another one that you touched on at the book launch event that we talked about. You said you wanted to come back to. I'm going to remind you.
Yes. I think this is the fun one. I'm kind of upset I didn't go over it, but
Selfishly,
you're going to hear Andrew go through a very short tarot card reading right now. So I wasn't joking when I'm going to so you can hear me mixing them. Hold on.
Is that what that is?
Yeah, let me give you a mix. And then I'm going to tie it back to P.T. Barnum, who was a circus promoter in the 19th century, who at a time had his autobiography was the second most printed book behind the Bible. Quite a remarkable promoter. All right, you just tell me stop anytime. I'm going to be riffing these cards.
Stop.
Okay. I'm going to just take out five cards here, and these cards, you can't see this, so I'm going to read out these five cards, and you don't have to say anything about them, while I read them, but I want you to then give me a score, a 1 out of 5, how relevant you think these are to you, okay?
Okay.
So
we're saying a live magic trick on the podcast here, guys. This is a world first. This is not a joke. Let's do it.
Okay. Okay. This one's, yeah. All right. I'll just say what it says here. This one says you have a tendency to be critical of yourself. All right. I'm just going to, next one here. This one says, while you have some personality weaknesses, you're generally able to compensate for them. Okay. The next one, the third card here. At times you're extroverted, affable, sociable, while at other times you're introverted, wary, or reserved. Two cards left. Okay. Okay. You... Sorry, but I got to say what it says on the card. You have a great need for other people to like and admire you. And the last one here. Okay. Some of your aspirations tend to be pretty unrealistic. Okay. Well.
Okay. So I'm answering how many of that five I would associate with, or I'm relevant.
Five being like, yes, this applies to me. Zero, this was totally off point.
But am I giving a score for each one, or just...
No, just in total.
Oh, okay. Well, there was one or two where I was like, yeah, that's pretty relevant. That's pretty relevant. The other three were like, yeah, probably not. So, I don't know, what, middle of the scale? Like 2.5?
Interesting. So, and this might... It's funny because the ones you picked here, there's basically 13. I read 5 of the 13 that come out of this thing called the Barnum Effect. So basically, listeners, we had an absolute failure of an example here. but those five, there were other things on here. Actually, some interesting ones, like your sexual adjustment has presented problems for you. Discipline and self-control on the outside, you tend to be worrisome and insecure inside. Anyways, what had happened that this psychologist in 1948, a guy named Forer, he'd taken a bunch of psychology students and he applied these personality tests and he made the students believe that each thing was individual to them. And what he had done instead is he went to like the newsstand astrology paper and had just written down 13 things that were relevant, that were from that issue. And he fed back these 13 points to them, and he didn't say astrology. Maybe this is part of where I went wrong with you, but he made it something that they believed in, which was psychology profiling. So okay. for a person like you, perhaps framing it as a tarot card reading. Yeah.
They're all wrong. They're ridiculous.
Yeah, ridiculous. So hence that didn't work. But anyways, he read these and he asked people to rate it from 1 to 5. And on average, they rated it at 4.26. So very high up as to these points are relevant to me. And
they all heard 5 points and they judged on aggregate the five were 4 out of 5 relevant. Wow.
Yeah, it was actually a total of 13 points, but just so people didn't totally fall asleep listening to this, I just kept it a 5. And they said 4.26, right? So they were convinced. And if you look at Darren Brown, I think Darren Brown did this as well, where he gave the same cold reading to a room of like 20 people. And then he comes out at the end and he says, right, so raise your hand. And some people got emotional. They were crying. They were just like, oh my gosh, this is so me. And he said, raise your hand if I'm reading yours, right? And as everyone had their hand in there, because everyone had word for word received the exact same fortune or whatever way you packaged it.
Right.
And the big point here is, and this is why it's called the Barnum effect. And P.T. Barnum was known for, while being a master marketer and promoter of circus and these kinds of shows, he also later in life took it upon himself. Just like Houdini and then James Randi did, where he debunked things like spirit readings and these kinds of things that were basically tricking the public and taking their money. And the big idea, this has been a lengthy explanation, but I want to tie it back. So it's somehow useful.
Hanging on here. It's so much anticipation.
If you can take your brand and you can explain an experience to someone that makes them feel like, yes, this is happening to me, like this is something that I would like to happen to me. Maybe you're selling fitness products and you're really making people feel inside of their head like it's something that they would really like, that if you space and give it a little bit of time, when they think of your brand, they have now essentially a fake memory inside their brain, and if you're crafty about it, they will that emotional feeling that they feel when they see maybe you're an affiliate marketer and you've got a personal brand. If you're able to make people feel emotionally something that is relevant to them. And like when I read those 5 points, I mean, those 5 points could have been applied to anyone. And some of those things about like the confident ones, like you have like Andrew, like knowing you're more confident than a lot of people you meet, but so it might not be the best astrology reading for you. But the point is, if you can describe an experience and make people feel it emotionally, down the line, they'll have a hard time differentiating between if it really happened or if it's something that they imagined. It's just like the narrative you tell yourself about stuff when you were 12, or you think about, getting rejected. Like if you're a guy, let's say getting rejected by a girl in your teenage years, and it's something that's, if there was a videotape rolling and you actually saw the rejection go down or whatever, it'd probably look a lot different than what you remember it as being. It's memories are malleable and you can affect them. And let's say you, and I'm going to stop talking here, but let's say you're offering travel. I've done quite a bit in the travel industry. If you give them photos at the end of their travel experience and they kind of highlight the good parts and maybe, don't highlight the things that weren't as great. If people then use those photos to remember their memories, they're going to have rose tinted glasses on what their experience was like. And you can actually change, if you're skillful, you can change the memory people have of experiencing your product or whatever. And that, I think that's where really good branding, good tone is able to move that.
So let me just clarify here, because I sense the importance of this. You said the idea is, and again, this is for people writing content a lot of times, you're mm-hmm. trying to describe, is it an experience that they will have had very vividly or an experience that they want to have?
It can be both. Like a very tangible example, there's a travel. This was for like this is Australia. They do like kind of luxurious walking, if you can believe that. It's basically you go for like 5 days, you go on the Great Ocean Road or the Grampians or whatever spot you want to visit. And when I did that empathy mapping and I was talking to these customers, I quickly found out that they did not want to be in those tour buses with all those other smelly tourists, mm-hmm. Getting the experience. They wanted to be unplugged from their phone, with their, maybe their girlfriends or these are like 50 to 70 year olds on average. Right. So they just kind of want to be like, forget technology. I want to walk in really pristine, amazing places without having to worry about a bunch of tourists stomping in the same path. Mm-hmm. And that implicit, I realized like their number one thing was unplugging, being in nature, being healthy, thinking of themselves as healthy, and importantly, not being stuck with all the other tourists. Mm-hmm. And so we recreated the page to make that the highlight. And the amount of action that homepage with that new USP had, had a conversion from 100 people came and one person ended up buying to 60 people came and one person ended up buying. And if you were getting the same amount of traffic because they were experiencing what they were really after, like a future focused memory, they wanted that memory to become real. And so they're more likely to buy. And likewise on the back end to increase the word of mouth, we'd give them a package of photos and have their tour guide, send them a nice little message, and that basically bookended their experience with a very pleasant ending, and people usually in any memory, in any experience, people remember the most intense moment and the ending moment, and so that way they tag both of those. So yeah, it can be any different ways. Yeah,
I get it. Yeah, and again, just super relevant to my audience, because a lot of times you get too bogged down in the selling of the product itself, but you're always selling an experience. You're always selling a way that a person's life will be if they make this decision, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, and then it's also what are they going to tell their friends? I mean, one last quick example. I used to do this little levitation in the street, and it actually kind of sucks. Like, I wouldn't touch this trick anymore. You maybe levitate, 2.5 inches, right? Like, 3 people would stand behind you, and I would go up about 3 inches, right? And it sucks. Like, I bought it on VHS. I remember consuming it, and the video said, when you turn around, take your hands and, like, put them maybe, like, a foot apart from each other and just wave them in front of them and ask, how high did I go? And you would just have like you wouldn't say, did I, like, you wouldn't make your hands like explicitly, like if you were just giving a measurement, but you would put your hands like that, kind of like one, your right hand more above your left hand. And you'd say, how high did I go? And you would anchor in people on that. They would have the emotion, you'd anchor them in on it, and sure enough, and I didn't believe this on the VHS, but then I saw them parroting back to me how high I went. They would actually put their hands, and maybe they would show 8 inches. They maybe wouldn't show a foot, but they would show 8 inches. I certainly didn't go up 8 inches. I barely went up 3. But it's amazing how memory, even fresh, can change.
Wow. Mate, there's enough for us here to keep digging into for perhaps the rest of our lives, but I did promise you this would only be an hour, so sure. I want to take the opportunity to thank you for being with us, Philippe. This was really informative.
My pleasure.
As I told you, I know you've had successes up until now, but things are about to take off for you. You don't even realize this is...
It's all my mom keeps saying, so thank you.
Hey, I hope we can, we just have to have a chapter 2 of this at some point, because I don't think we even really scratched the surface on some of those principles and how they apply.
Yeah, I mean, if you're an affiliate or you're in the marketing profession, I mean, that's part of the pleasure of you know, we gotta mess about with human behavior, and that's something that, you know, not to take lightly. It's an exciting field.
I agree with you. Mate, thanks again for doing this. I'll catch up with you soon.
I look forward to it.
Bye.
Bye-bye.